Okay, so I was thinking about metastasis, you know, more in the, to review for you the functional and biological variables in metastasis. And this is supposed to be an arrow, actually. So the field of metastasis has evolved tremendously, and there are numerous candidates that are thought to be playing very important role in different stages of metastasis, different steps of metastasis, and a lot of them have been studied gene at a time. And I think more latest technology, some of the ones that Siv alluded to in relation to bioinformatics approaches, may now allow us to look at genome-wide approach to studying metastasis. And the critical question, of course, in all of this is, what are the critical drivers of metastasis and cancer evolution? Can we identify rate-limiting steps that can stop the cancer cell in its track for during cancer development or during its dissemination to distant organs? So with that in mind, I will review for you some of the basic principles in cancer biology and metastasis cascade, and then eventually go over to the possibly a genome-wide approach that we are following and that I would like to share with you, that we don't have any fantastic results from that approach, but that's the way we are going about it. And I would like to just share that with you. So cancer is a disease where we have cumulative genetic and epigenetic aberrations that occur in a stochastic manner over a very long period of time. Histologically, one can view these changes, you know, as transformation of the normal epithelium into aberrant, dysplastic, atypical cell. And then as cancer stages progress, you see the early adenoma, late adenoma, and eventually invasive cancer, and the last stage being the metastasis, where the cancer has spread from the primary site to the distant organs, which are often bone and lung, liver, disrupting the fundamental function of these organs, leading to cancer mortality. So although metastasis is depicted as the later stage in cancer development, it is very much thought that metastasis may actually occur very early during cancer development, and perhaps the cancer cells sit in a distant organ for a very prolonged period of time in a dormant state before they become fully able to colonize metastasis and grow and disrupt the organ. So metastasis is not necessarily the last stage of cancer, although it culminates at the last stage of cancer. Metastatic cells may occur and disseminate to these organs much earlier. And so the factors that play into the cancer development are, of course, exogenous factor, our lifestyle, environmental exposure, and hormones. There's been considerable discussion about use of plastics recently and how that might be acting as estrogens to stimulate, you know, aberrant processes. And then, of course, cancer cells by themselves have endogenous factors that play majorly into the development of cancer development. And these require very fundamental processes like alterations or mutations in genes that regulate the DNA mismatch repair, tumor suppressor genes becoming inactivated, and all there may be certain polymorphisms in populations that may allow greater susceptibility to these type of exposure and allowing these inserts to occur on cells during the transformation from normal state to the cancer stage. Most of these processes are very fundamental, and these aberrations eventually culminate into disrupting networks, regulatory networks in the cell that really keep the cell in keeping its normalcy, and aberrations of those networks that actually underlies the genesis of the cancer. So Hanahan and Weinberg a few years ago very nicely reviewed the six hallmarks of cancer, which involves an earlier dysregulation in pathways that control cell death. And these are called apoptosis, and disruption of apoptosis regulators can be an early event in the development of cancer. Similarly, ability to generate growth signals that provide self-sufficiency to the cancer cells is an important early acquisition in the cancer cascade. Now, with relation to metastasis, processes of angiogenesis is thought to be very important. Entogenesis also required. Entogenesis is the process where new blood vessels are formed by endothelial cells sprouting. And if you have a very micro lesion without angiogenesis, that lesion may not grow beyond a certain size. And it's thought that the development of a cancer or neoplastic lesion beyond a certain size requires its angiogenesis, and much must have the angiogenic switch occurring for it to grow beyond a certain stage. And then again, angiogenesis is a very important process during metastasis, as this is the way the cancer cells gain access to the circulatory system. Another event that's very important for metastasis is the tissue invasion by cancer cells. As the cancer cells stochastically acquire additional changes, certain specific alterations give the cancer cells advantage to break down the extracellular matrix barriers and gain access to the blood vessels. So these are some of the hallmarks that were described a few years ago. Now, very new interesting concepts have been built into these ideas. One is the idea of cancer cells having a very fundamental different metabolism compared to the normal state. And that metabolism then feeding into a number of these parameters and promoting these parameters. So cancer cells are thought to inherently utilize their metabolic pathways differently than normal cells. Another concept that's very interesting right now is the concept of cancer stem cells that Dr. Hill will be talking about later on. So some of the fundamental processes that are altered in molecular genetics of cancer is the activation of oncogenes. And these oncogenes are often representing important growth factors or growth factor receptors and signaling pathways or anti-apoptotic protein. And what really is happening is with the activation of these proto-oncogenes, the cell does not then have to depend on other cells to grow. It becomes self-sufficient in its growth ability because it can now synthesize growth factors that it requires, or it has now amplified or mutated growth factor receptors, and that by itself become activated, leading into critical signaling pathways, and eventually many of these pathways impinge on the transcription factors as well as alterations that lead to DNA copy number changes in the cancer. Another big category of genes to look out for are the tumor suppressors, which have been divided into caretakers and gatekeepers. Gatekeepers are those that are important for regulating normal cell proliferation, and caretakers are those that specifically impinge on generating additional mutations. So loss of tumor suppressor genes are very important, and they let go of the rate limiting pathways during the development of cancer. So these are just some of the examples of genes that fall in these categories. Now, Siv already showed this schematic before. This is just a very simple schematic of many of the signaling pathways that feed into regulating those protein networks or signal transduction pathways that are important for maintaining a normal function of the cell. There are many growth factors like EGF receptor growth factor, PI3 kinase P10 pathways that are thought to be really central to affecting cancer cell growth. However, one thing that's very important in remembering the cancer development, and specifically metastasis, is that the tissue cell microenvironment or tumor microenvironment plays very important role in allowing these signals to be interpreted differently. So here is a cell, but the cell never really exists inside the body in isolation. It's always in the context to cell adhesion and cell extracellular matrix adhesion, and I'll give you an example in the next slide. So a cell really is surrounded by a complex microenvironment that's constituted by the structural matrix. It has other cell types like inflammatory cell types, immune cells, macrophages are very important, critical part of the cell microenvironment. Then the cell is always adjacent to another cell, and communication through the two cells occurs through the cell adhesion molecules. And of course, we have growth factors and growth factors receptors on the cell surface. Along with these, the other things, important factors in the microenvironment are the cytokines and chemokines, which provide chemotactic signals to the cells, which are important for their ability to invade and metastasize. So these are, and also proteases, that a family of proteins that we work on. These proteases are soluble in the microenvironment, and some of them are actually anchored on the cell surface. And then what proteases do is they cleave these growth factors, or they can cleave growth factor binding proteins or chemokines or cytokines, and they modulate the signals within the cell microenvironment. So they help interpret the signals that are generated in the microenvironment through the cell. And a cell's ability to interpret these signals also becomes evolved as the cancer develops and requires, additional changes towards metastatic dissemination. So another way of looking at the cell microenvironment, there are many, many players. And they all may be singing in key during normal physiology, but this synchrony between many of these growth factors and facets of the cell microenvironment become dysregulated during cancer development. And understanding the cell microenvironment is very important, because cell environment is actually very powerful. Oftentimes, if you take a cancer cell and you put it in a normal tissue, it will actually reestablish its polarity as well as normal structure and move away from the transformed phenotype. So cell microenvironment can hold very powerful cues for cancer. So these are just the normal structures of the human breast tissue and H&E stain section, lung, prostate, and uterus. And you can see exquisitely organized structures here. Here's an epithelial duct, which is always a single layer of epithelial cells surrounded by a myoepithelial cell, and that's surrounded by the matrix. And these are the fibroblasts or the immune cells around in this microenvironment. Here is a lung. You can see the structure of lung from the breast is very different. However, breast cells will often metastasize to lung. Here's the uterus. And in fact, each of these epithelial structures provide the functional unit for these tissues. And here you can see these functional units, which are surrounded by the extracellular matrix here. In fact, it's stained by laminin. So you can see the extracellular matrix, the structural constraints of the tissues are very well defined in normalcy. And breakage of this barriers, of the structural barriers, is a very important step in cancer cell invasion and metastasis. So often, now here is a tissue H&E section from invasive breast cancer, and you can see it has some certain similarities to these compartments, but you see huge dysregulation. The normal epithelial ducts are disorganized, adipocytes have been pushed away, and this is the big, there's a total loss of form and function between the two at this stage. So what happens in metastasis? The metastatic cell is almost considered to be a very tricky cell. It's the one, actually, that silver showing, you know, person going through one on the tightrope, you know. It has to be able to maneuver multiple steps to be able to successfully metastasize. So here are some of the events that people think are important in the metastatic cascade. As the cancer cell expands, it is thought that the metastatic cells may acquire greater heterogeneity or genetic changes to give them those advantages that will then allow them to breach the extracellular matrix, cross this matrix barrier, gain access, intravasate into the blood vasculature, survive in the blood vasculature, not all the mechanical forces, but also immune cells, lodge into a distant organ eventually, come out of the blood vessels called extravasation, and then grow, either sit there no dormant for a while, or generate micrometastases, or then one day make fully metastatic nodules disrupting the organ function. Now this invasion and metastasis spread doesn't always have to occur through the blood vasculature. It's actually the earlier stages of metastasis dissemination often occurs through lymphatics, and often solid tumors surround the resident lymph nodes in the area are the first to be manifested by cancer cells. So metastatic dissemination can occur viscerally for tumors such as ovarian cancer, where it spreads within the visceral cavity, or it can occur through lymphatics or to distant organs by angiogenesis. So, breakdown of ECM, intravasation, traveling, lodging, and again, extravasation are thought to be very important stages of metastasis. So the way people have been studying metastasis, there had been a real tremendous surge many almost a decade ago, 15 years ago, to tag and image cancer cells. So one of the first initial steps people used were use beta-galactosidase gene expression, which gave the cells blueness. You know, you could stain the cells here for beta-galactosidase expression, and you can see this is a mouse brain bearing metastasis. Here is again, you know, a thick section of the brain. You can actually see the metastatic cells coming out of the blood vessels. Here's metastatic colonization of the liver. This is just a TIMP low liver that has low protease inhibitor expression. It shows you more metastatic dissemination than the wild type liver. So blue cells were used initially to tag metastatic cells. Now again, where there's been a great surge of fluorescent proteins have come about, green fluorescent proteins, and there are many different types now, which allow you to actually tag different cell populations of metastases. And now you can perform, you can take two cell populations, one, let's say, greater expression of VEGF, and another lesser expression. You can do comparative studies in the same organ by differentially tagging them with different fluorescence proteins. Another way imaging has come into play for studying metastasis is by intravital imaging of organs after injecting a mouse. Let's say you inject a mouse into the mesenteric with fluorescence or melanoma cells, which are naturally melanin expressing and black, and therefore can be identified. And then you can track the metastatic cell extravasation into the liver parenchyma and allow their initial behavior. Here is a single cancer cell coming out of the blood vessel. You can appreciate the convoluted structure and invadopodia, it sends to wrap around the blood vessels and eventually extravasate into the parenchyma. In fact, some of these protrusions can be extremely long. So cancer cells and metastatic cells have a very increased flexibility, and they utilize that to extravasate in the tissue. And Dr. Chambers has used intravital video microscopy to image metastatic extravasation, and her work has challenged some of the dogmas that were established earlier on with respect to metastases. These are some metastatic cells that have been labeled with quantum dots. And as you know, the variety of quantum dots, which are inert dots, are very large. You can actually do some very nice with the QD labeled metastatic cells. And then these cells give you the advantage of actually dissociating the tissue eventually and isolating the quantum dot labeled metastatic cells and quantifying them precisely. Because the ability to quantify metastasis precisely, which I think might be an important part of mathematical modeling, is a very tricky business and not easy to perform. So instead of going through many of the processes, what I thought I will review for, there has been a lot of activity in the field of angiogenesis and lymphangiogenesis, where, for instance, lymphangiogenesis is the invasion through the lymphatics, which is, this field is not as well studied as angiogenesis, but right now there's a great spurt of activity in this area, and people are identifying how specific forms of VEGF and specific VEGF receptors are involved in lymphangiogenesis. Motility and invasion, especially in 3D collagen structures, which more accurately mimic the in vivo tissue, is a focus of area for many labs. And here there's an interest in finding out which of any of the proteases play important role in metastatic dissemination, with the idea of identifying rate-limiting proteases, which will not be redundant, which will be absolutely essential for metastatic or cancer cell motility. If we can identify those, then maybe therapies can be directed in that direction. Similarly, cell adhesion and cell ECM adhesion through integrin which are on cell surface, and how these integrins interact with collagen molecule or extracellular matrix molecules, that's an area of huge interest. Similarly, chemotaxis and homing to organs is an active area. There's also very interesting ideas about how hematopoietic cell and system might go and energize the distant organs, creating a metastatic niche ahead of time, thus thereby maybe altering the microenvironment a little bit, to which the metastatic cell will eventually home. So these are very interesting ideas. And then, of course, there is the study of dormancy, cancer cell dormancy. What make a cell, often enough times, cancers are diagnosed and then treated. But metastasis occurs 5 years to 25 years later. And it is thought that the metastatic cells that have already homed to the distant organs stay dormant for very prolonged times. And right now there's a great emphasis on defining the molecular mechanisms that dictate dormancy. Is it the cell undergoing a quiescent state? Is the cell becoming senescent? What are the active mechanisms that are keeping this cancer cell under control? But a lot of these studies have occurred with a gene at a time approach. You know, you take a single gene of your interest, you modulate it in either the cancer cell line or in the host. The host can be a transgenic mouse that has a gain of function, or you give it a loss of function by creating a knockout. So by gain or function and gain or loss of function within the host organism, typically mouse or the cancer cell lines, these processes have been often studied. And for modeling metastasis, a lot of these studies involve metastasis where you take a bolus of cancer cells and already injected intravascularly or through another route into the circulation system, and then you do not model the initial steps, but you model the dissemination, circulation, and dissemination into the distant organ. Another approach to study metastasis is, of course, to study spontaneous metastasis through the use of cancer models, and I'll give you an example. So here's just an example from our work, where we made TIM3, TIMP overexpressing mice, or down-regulated mice. These mice, as well as TIM3 knockout mice, which totally lack TIM3 in multiple organs. And by performing combinatorial studies, where we allow the tumor to grow just subcutaneously, or we inject the cancer cells directly into the blood vascular, and depending on where you inject, you can target multiple organs of the in the body by choosing the source of injection. So through this way, we've been able to study that loss of TIM3 allows advantages for the angiogenesis switch. It allows greater tumor growth as well as metastatic dissemination. And another, so for the study of spontaneous metastasis, of course, one requires cancer models. One example of that is the MMPV polyomavirus T mouse. In this case, mammary gland specific, breast cancer specific promoter is used to drive a viral oncogene into the mammary gland epithelial cells, and that gives rise to mammary tumors in these mice reproducibly. And now you can take this somewhat spontaneously developing breast cancer model, and you can cross it into specific mice that lack a particular gene. For example, beta 1 integrin, which is the receptor for the extracellular matrix molecules. And people have shown that by combining the deletion of beta 1 with the polyoma middle T, you can totally knock down metastasis. Now, there are tricks to these generating these combinatorial knockouts, and really the technologies are much more advanced. Right now, people can create specific deletion of a gene within an organ or a tissue, or within even cell types within specific organs. So by generating these combinations with a spontaneously occurring metastatic model, you can model metastasis. So there's a number, a lot of knowledge coming out on functional variables that dictate metastasis. We know that metastasis is a highly inefficient process. Where the inefficiency lies has been a point of debate. Quantifying metastasis burden, especially micrometastasis, I think remains a major hurdle. There's a major emphasis on isolating cancer cells that are in circulation, metastatic cells, and then analyzing them. VEGF family is thought to be very important for angiogenesis, lymphangiogenesis. Certain proteases are thought to be extremely important for motility of cells and tumor cells in the 3D collagen context. And there are a major impetus in finding out cytokines such as RANK ligand, which is thought to be a major factor for chemotaxis and home to bone for breast and prostate metastasis. On the other hand, there's very limited understanding of cancer stem cell concept or niche concept with respect to metastasis. And there is a considerable debate about how heterogeneity, whether heterogeneity is an essential part of metastatic evolution. And of course, dormancy. If you can understand that, then therapies could be targeted. So I will skip this slide and I'll show you a few slides on how genome-wide approaches perhaps can be used to model metastasis and find those driver genes rather than going for one gene at a time. And the reason genome-wide approach is now possible is because of the multiple high-throughput genome-wide technologies that are available. There has been, after the sequencing of human genome, just the genome sequencing technologies are much more advanced and can be done much more rapidly. There are ways to scan the copy number, DNA copy number changes very efficiently for cancer genome, for instance. And there is, so this kind of advances have given rise to this approach called comparative integrative oncogenomics, which what that entails is you take, there have been some very nice reports on this, and we've been utilizing in our lab. What you do is you take a cancer model for a human cancer, a mouse model for a human cancer, and you generate information from this model at the DNA, RNA, and protein level. And you scan through this integrative approach, and you try and identify what could be possibly the driver genes for a certain process, let's say metastasis in this case. Then you model, you generate the same information from actual human cancer at the same DNA, RNA, protein level, and you pitch that information back and forth and try use each of the species as a biofilter for the other to distill down those driver genes. So I want to give you an example here. Show you example for human osteosarcoma. So osteosarcomas are bone cancers that arise in long bones very frequently. We made a mouse model for osteosarcoma, and you can see these tumors by the radiography, just like an x-ray of the mouse. So it's a good model for bone cancer. Now we take these mouse tumors, osteosarcoma tumors, and we analyze them at the RNA level, at the DNA level, at high resolution, as well as the protein level for also some validation. And we take that information from the DNA protein level and we try and distill down to certain driver genes. And then we do the parallel experiment with the human osteosarcoma to see if we can find the driver genes. So here's an example of the type of karyotypic changes in the chromosome of the osteosarcoma you will see. Typically there are two, these should be diploid, and now you can see they're actually tetraploid for, like you see for the human disease. And each of the red line here shows you gain of DNA and the green shows you loss. So there are tremendous amount of genomic instability in this mouse model. There's a copy number gains and losses. And on each chromosome, if you stack, so we've done 17 tumors. If you stack all the 17 tumors, you can begin to now see within the chromosomes there are hot spots. And the idea is to find those hot spots that are very recurrent. And we went for one of the hot spots, which was on chromosome 11. And then what you do is you take that chromosome 11, that region, and specifically look at the RNA expression profile generated for the same sequence of genes that are placed on here. And what we see here is that the red signifies a deletion of this particular locus, which is a very focused small deletion. And you can see only in the samples that are deleted, you see lesser RNA expression. So we nominated this particular candidate as a likely driver. And then when we do complement this with other non-biased clustering techniques, we see that there are actually two subsets of osteosarcomas that we find, and this aberration lies in within one subset. And I won't take you through all of the human data. We think we have found similar, same candidate when low expressed in the human osteosarcoma here, it signifies a subclass. With this kind of exercise, we've taken it down to a pKa signaling pathway and a critical ligand. And when we cross that gene deficiency into the osteosarcoma model, we completely abrogate the osteosarcoma development. But the question is, can you actually apply this approach to metastasis? And since this mouse model metastasizes spontaneously, you can see the lung tumors as well as liver tumors, which are having these bony deposits because they are bone cancers. And you can image these metastatic nodules by another imaging techniques. And what was very surprising, and this is just a pilot result, we have only done 3 metastases so far, but we were very surprised. This is primary tumor showing by array CGH technology and metastasis with array CGH technology. So now you can see there was so much noise for each of the chromosomes for the primary tumors, but that noise is primarily gone in metastasis. This genome is much more quieter than the primary tumors. And now you zoom in, again, you see the primary tumor, many, many copy number alterations, but only very few are reflected in the metastasis. And the idea here now will be to take a look at that, but now compare the mouse osteosarcoma metastases to the human osteosarcoma metastases and try and distill down what will be the driver genes. However, it's almost impossible to find metastasis tissue. You know, it's ethically not easy to obtain, and it's just a very rare tissue. So in order to circumvent that limitation, we have gone to dog osteosarcoma metastases. And the reason for that is dog osteosarcomas develop very similarly to those of the humans. And in the dog, you can identify and isolate the primary tumor as well as the metastases. So now if you do these high-throughput technologies on the mouse, human and dog metastases, use the bio-cross-species biofiltering back and forth, we think we may be able to, you know, find a few candidates. But then, of course, once we find those candidates, we'll again have to go back to that gene at a time. The candidate we find, we must validate it by this approach to see whether it really holds the power to suppress that metastasis related to the osteosarcoma. So the last point is for mathematical modeling of metastasis, although I have no understanding of that, I was trying to think what are the important aspects. I think quantifying metastasis is a very difficult thing and may be required to fairly high degree for modeling metastasis, but I don't know. So there are individual steps to the metastatic cascade, and those steps are inherent to the cancer cells. Many of them are inherent to the stroma or the microenvironment of the tumor, and these things are very closely intertwined, very difficult to separate, because the cancer cells very much in tune with this microenvironment, and there are multiple genes required for each of those steps that I was talking about. And how one models that, I think, remains a complex situation. It'll be fun to see how you guys do it, and we'd love to work with you guys. Especially if you take the bioinformatics approach, we are often lost with designing algorithms to pitch this information back and forth, and I think there'll be very nice opportunities to perhaps collaborate. The important thing is to find those molecular factors, driver genes, versus the bystanders. So we want to be able to distinguish the two sets of genes if there are such. And there are definitely certain driver genes for specific cancers. And this whole genome-wide approach holds the power of generating very large sums of information, which then has to be filtered to, again, get back to the driver gene. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.